Hey guys, welcome to the H-Weighing podcast, the podcast talking about all aspects of motorsport, from four wheels to two wheels and everything in between. I'm your host, Nick Yellerly, factory driver for BMW. I'm joined by fellow Brummie and host Jake Hughes, Rocket Ventry Formula E reserve driver.
On today's show, we have a good friend of ours. He's raced and won races in all of the junior categories. He has raced in Indy 500 a couple of times, and he's been a reserve driver for Manor in Formula One. He's also a full-time Ironman triathlete. So to here to talk about that and tell us when he's entering Kona, it's Jordan King. How you doing, mate?
Yeah, good, thank you. That was a bit of a big intro I've got to live up to, but no, you know, good to actually see you guys in a lockdown and all that. So yeah,
that's the best intro we've got so far, I think.
Yeah, definitely getting better, aren't we?
almost made me sound professional, but that would have been a one step too far.
How did it all start then for you? How did racing sort of, you know, not, I guess you started in karting, but how did that sort of come about?
Well, if we go back further enough, since as far back as I can remember, I've always wanted to be a sportsman of some kind. And yeah, like kind of every normal child, if there is such thing as a normal child, I played, you know, rugby, football, cricket, did the normal sports as you do at school. And it wasn't until my 11th birthday that I went to a place called Mr. Karting, which is just down the road from where I live. I think Nick's been there a few times.
That's where I started too.
Sounds like the best place you could start, Mr. Yeah. Karting.
Where I started too, mate, it's where legends are born.
It's closed now. They closed because of COVID forever.
Oh, completely?
Yeah, yeah. Oh. Completely. Oh. God. No, the local newspaper's calling me up saying how much of a devastated they are. No.
Where was that?
Tatchford Park, wasn't it? Something like that. It's like one of the estates just off, out of sight of Leamington.
Yeah, it's on Harbury Lane.
Yeah. I'm surprised I've never been there.
A campaign to get it going again. So anyway,
yeah, we should.
There's two international racing drivers that started at Mr. Karting. And yeah, 11th birthday party, there was a couple of like mates that year that also had their birthday party at Mr. Karting, as kind of you do at that age. And Alan, the owner, came up to my dad after one and said, like, oh, you've come now five or six times and your son's not a complete idiot. Like, he kind of knows how to get it around the track. Have you ever thought about actually doing karting? And what I would then call proper karting, outdoors, you know, big track. So by the time I was in 12, I'd started driving outdoors on big tracks in cadets. The first ever track I went around was PF. So going from a small indoor place to PF was obviously, you know, a big jump. But then went up to the British Championship. And then, as you guys will know, but go from your cadets through to Minimax, then went to what was KF3, probably JICA back in your day, Nick. You're a few years ahead of me.
Yeah, that's right.
And then KF2, and it's all changed again now. I don't know what they're called. So yeah, kind of went up the karting ranks from there, really. And then the next step is into kind of the junior level of cars, which I did at 17. So I did about 5 years of karting before I moved into cars, and then same similar sort of process again.
Nice, nice. I mean, yeah, like you say, I was maybe a little bit ahead in terms of age, but actually starting at, I started at 15. So what year would you have started karting?
07.
Yeah. So similar. I think I started end of 06. Oh, I can't remember if it's 05 or I think it was 06, September 06. So yeah, I guess similar time.
We actually like raced each other at Mr. Karting without even knowing.
And never known. Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised.
I would have been at the front, of course, and you'd have been at the back somewhere. So that's probably
it's only because I'm so much heavier because of the muscle content that I have in my body.
I feel like we're missing a trick here. I feel like there's an investment opportunity waiting to happen. We've got to bring it back.
Start a crowdfunding campaign and get Mr. Karting going again.
Yeah, what exactly would you call it though this time?
Mr. Karting, how much?
Yeah, just gotta be. It just has to be, doesn't it? It's just, you can't get a better name than Mr. Karting. And it's a real shame that.
You've got to go Mr. and Mrs. Karting now.
Okay, of course.
Yeah,
exactly. Just a bit more straight and narrow on that sense. But it's a shame that it did shut, because Alan, and who what was his son's name? Because he actually did a bit of racing in junior TKM as well, or TKM at the time.
I don't know.
Yeah, but they were both really, really good cars. So it's a shame that obviously we've gone off on a tangent and talking about Mr. Karting again, but it just shows how much fun it was when we were there.
You were a factory driver at Birrell, weren't you?
You're talking to me or Nick?
You, well, you, yeah. You're a guest, mate. Yeah,
my last year, like the I started the year around energy, an energy car, and that relationship with the team that I was with kind of went a little bit sour halfway through the year. The second half of my last year in karts was in KF2. We got picked up by Birrell and kind of had a stonking end to the year, which was pretty good.
It's always nice to do just before you go into cars, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. It kind of felt right there. We had a bad start to the year and kind of twiddling our fingers in the middle of the year and, got the opportunity. And it's one of those strange ones. You go from like a little private team to then actually like the factory team, and it's something like, oh, this is why they're always quicker than us.
Exactly right. Yeah, it is funny. And then first couple of years in cars then, so I think you did you do 2 litre Renault first, like the most in Euro Cup?
Yeah, so went back to, no, I did UK Renault for my first year. So it was one of those, you know, karting, you start off in the domestic championships and kind of go through to the world championships. And then it's almost starting again when you first go into cars. So I started off in like British Renault, then went to like European Renault and then Formula 3. So I did Renault for 2 years, Formula 3 for 2 years, and then into Formula 2 after that.
Okay. And then results wise, if I remember, you won the British F3 Championship?
Won British F3.
Yeah.
My first year of F3 in Europe, fifth or sixth.
Like yeah.
Top hockey, had a mega year, was like, well, happy. And then the second year, we just blew up and crashed and ended up.
Had one of those ones, yeah.
Yeah, it was one of those that I had, the first year as a rookie, I only had like one or two podiums. Didn't have many, but was always quite consistent. Ended up like fifth. And then in the second year, we had like 15 podiums, but no other results. Everything else was like rubbish. So I scored well when I did score, but then had loads of zeros, which, as you know, is consistency. That's the main part of any championship.
Yeah. And then you, what point did you, were you in GP2 when you went with Manor?
So my first year in GP2, I did. Did have a relationship with Manor in my first year in GP2. And then the second year, that grew to then the reserve test driver. That would have been in 2015 then, that year.
Yeah, we actually did a few. Sorry to interrupt. We actually did a couple of races together. It was 15. I think you were racing engineering teammates with Rossi, right?
Yeah, that was my first year in 2015. And then 2016 was the second year where kind of the Manor relationship grew a bit more.
Sure. Yeah, I remember those days. And going back a little bit, we ask everyone that's come on just because it's interesting to hear different people's point of view. But when you took the step from karting to cars, how did you find it? Did you find it super difficult? Did you just jump in and were quick? I mean, from my experience, I struggled like for definitely the first half of the year, particularly as we had to do the real driving with the actual stick shift and sequential flips and whatnot. But I really struggled to extract, say, the most out of a new tyre. How did you find it?
Yeah, a similar process. I actually found the stick shift much easier. Any car that I drove with stick shift, or relative, obviously pulling paddles is really easy. But the thing I always found for the first couple of years that anyone can pull a paddle to a certain degree. So actually kind of bad drivers, it just closed the field up. My first year in Renault, I just struggled a bit, really. It was one of those, I don't know about you, but when you first came into cars, did very limited testing. You know, I still karted right up until kind of the last minute and then made the decision quite late on to go into cars that year. So I'd only done, you know, three or four test days before like the first race, and thought I was doing a good job, as you always do in testing. And the other guy in the car, I won't not drop any names. He doesn't race anymore, I don't think. That we're kind of doing the 3 or 4 days testing with. I was miles quicker than, so I just thought, oh, this is going to be well easy. It'll be really good. And got to the first qualifying session. It was at Snetterton. Yeah, Snetterton. And I was like 2.5 seconds off. And I was like, oh, this is not good. Yeah. And then it was like a bit of a reality check. Actually, you need to like work a bit harder and everything. And got myself my first pole. But just after the halfway point in the season, something like that. So it was
good progression.
It was one of those that we, realized something had hit the fan and needed to kind of actually get a head down and work a bit towards it. But alluding to the stick shift, the first ever car I drove was Formula Palmer Audi, and I did a race in that and found actually like the stick shift, because you can manipulate the car more. And I don't know, it just made more sense to me, driving with actually something like a gear lever in your hand and actually having to change gear when it felt right to change gear, rather than just pulling a paddle and the car doing all the, you know,
all the work
for you. So yeah, I think relative, I was like, had more of an advantage on the brakes, and that sort of thing. Like first year in Formula 3 was a stick shift. And I went from being like one of the best on the brakes in the team in year one to then year two just being average, because everyone can hit the brakes and pull a paddle. So yeah, I actually struggled with getting an advantage with the paddles.
Paddles, yeah. I heard a story, actually. I think we all know David Hale relatively well, and he ran Marco Asma to the Formula 3 title many years ago with Hi-Tech, and he said, "Oh, to Marco, do you ever use, you know, the clutch a little bit to go down the shifts, and how do you manipulate it?" It's like, no, I just pull the paddle. So they actually took the clutch further away from him without him knowing, just to see if he was telling the truth. And he got all or slightly flustered and out of sync, because there was little tricks and bits that he did to manipulate the car way better than anyone else in the team that he wasn't even realizing he was doing at the time. So it just shows that. And I completely agree. I preferred the stick shift way more than the paddles, just because of that extra bit of skill. Anything that's a bit more agricultural, actually, in the racing terms, whether it was tracks, the way you drive it, it's old school and much, much preferred. So yeah, completely agree with you there, mate. Yeah.
I remember my first test in the 2 liter after my third year in karting was with the paddles, the 2011 car, but I did it in 2012. And then I did a private test, but there was hardly any cars there in the BARC car. So with the stick shift, then you had to blip, obviously, when you're going down. But there wasn't any competition there. So I thought I was a hero coming away from that test. Like I'd done well. I'd gone to the paddle shift test and done quite well. Then went to this quiet test in the stick shift and was, you know, thought I was amazing. And then in my first race or second race, I was, first proper race, it was with the end of the season, 2012 Formula Renault grid. BARC grid on National Silverstone. There was about 40 cars on the four corner national track, and I was about 39th or, you know, something like that. I remember thinking, what the hell have I got myself in for here? Like,
we've all been there. I think I was second or third to last as well.
Not new news, I think, unless you're like some of these younger guys today that seem to have more backing than ever before, and more time on their hands than ever before, because they don't go to school or have a life outside motorsport. So they're, you know, when they've done 50 days of testing, you'd expect to be up to speed. But I know for myself, and I'm pretty sure you guys were the same, you know, once you've done 3 or 4 days and you get yourself up to speed, so you're comfortable, you know what's going on, you can do race starts and all of that stuff, but you're still not quick enough. And basing yourself off winter lap times when the track's cold, no wind, you can bring the tires in however you want, it's not a 20-minute qualifying session, and there's no one else on the track, so you can just drive where you want, how you want, and you feel good. And I actually, that was quite a good point. In Rockingham, I did a test in Rockingham, and I went like 0.2 quicker than pole and thought, oh yeah, this is going to be well easier, we're going to be on pole. But then you overlaid the data and it was like we were 10k quicker down every straight,
yeah,
and quicker through like half the corners, purely just the fact that the track was better and the ambient temperature and just the whole thing. So I think that's part of the kind of problem with young drivers, is they don't really have a set.
Yeah. But I think we all have to kind of go for it, but we kind of do it in our different ways, don't we? Because like you say, if you've got the money to and the luxury to be able to do it and sort of get through your, let's say, 20 to 30 days of testing and sort of learn the ropes of it before you even set foot in a race, you know, you first race, you keep them confident straight away. Like you don't get your head kicked in, you know, by everyone else in doing sort of going, learning the ropes properly, or not properly, but sort of like how we have to do it. And I think everyone has to do it, but you see at that early level who's sort of had the time in the car and who hasn't, I think.
Yeah, I think it's very obvious at the junior level who's had the time in the car and who hasn't. And then when you get to the top, it all starts to merge a bit more. Mm. But yeah, as you say, like the confidence still stays there all the way, doesn't it?
Yeah. It's all about riding the wave almost of like, you know, some people ride the wave of their hype from karting all the way through.
Yeah. There's people now that I look at that have got contracts and you think, how are they in a race seat? They've not done anything. And then you look back and say, like, oh yeah, they won the world championship 10 years ago and they've just ridden that wave ever since.
Yeah.
It seems to be held them in good stead. I mean, the junior formula thing is a funny thing, but I mean, more importantly, we're coming to like the end of that, or I mean, I'm not in the junior formula, none of us really in junior formula anymore, which is a nice thing in a way. So it's the sort of the pro ranks. On your junior career, obviously you've tested Formula One, you've done GP2, you've tested World Series Renault, I think, you've done F3. Which would you be your favourite car to drive on a lap? Bar Formula One. Sorry? Maybe bar Formula One for now. I know.
I reckon the World Series cars may be better.
Yeah. No, to be honest with you, actually, the GP2 car.
Yeah.
I found with 2015... that sort of time to be probably one of the best cars I've ever driven on a single lap. You know, Formula 3, the old proper Formula 3 was really nice, but you also only had 250 horsepower. But where, you know, the GP2 car, they were up towards 600 horsepower and I think 550. But they were light as well. They were below 800 kilos with driver, I think, if I get my numbers right. So you were pretty much one-to-one. And they were just quick, had some good downforce. You could get a pretty good balance front to rear, so it was consistent. Whereas you mentioned that the World Series car, although they were a similar level of performance, I always found the balance was very compromised, purely from the fact it only had a monoshock front damper.
Yeah.
So to actually compensate that, you had to compensate the car quite a bit, where actually with the GP2 car, it was, you know, pretty open to change what you needed to get a good balance from the car.
How would you compare, like, because I think you drove obviously a year with the new F2 car as well. I'm not sure if you drove it with the new 18-inch wheels or not.
Not with the new 18-inch wheels, but yeah, the new car. It's not as good as the old one. It's not as good.
No. I kind of knew you were going to say that.
Yeah, it's still a good car, but it's heavier and the turbo engine. It's just not as nice to drive as a normally aspirated one.
No, I mean, I did that one race in Sochi with the 18-inch wheels and I didn't like it compared to F3. I felt the F3 car was a better car.
That sort of car on one weekend, though. You know, when I first jumped in at the first test, I was like, yeah, this is a bit rubbish. But once you kind of get into it and stuff, it comes to you a bit more in enjoyment factor.
Yeah. I always wish I had a go in that GP2 car or a test or something. Every time I saw it on TV, I thought that looks pretty cool.
There's a few floating around somewhere if you've got some spare change. I'm sure.
Boss GP or something like that.
Yeah, just bank transfer it up.
Boss GP world champion.
I think you're right in terms of the car, because I obviously raced 2012, I raced the World Series, and I thought over a lap, for me at that time, or over a race distance, it was just a beast because you had the Michelin tyres. the first year of it, you had the higher horsepower than they reduced for the years after the side skirt. So it was super, super fast. But jumping in, I did five or six races, I think, in GP2 with Hilmer in 2015. And I can remember, say, races in Silverstone, actually, where me and you may not remember, John, but we're super close. We came into the pits and then Racing Engineering did a better pit stop than you were in front of me.
Pits and then
went away, and I was like, oh,
I got knocked off last corner, last lap. Where I was in like fifth, and you were in seventh or something. Yeah. And Charles Peak or Arthur Peak,
he knocked you off, yeah,
knocked me off, yeah,
last corner. Yeah. That was a nightmare. Actually, I was starting, so I was eighth, and then you got knocked off, and I finished seventh, so I started on for second for the day after.
So, with that, Charles Peak, was it Arthur? Which I can't remember.
Arthur, Charles was the older one.
So I got knocked off. Arthur then got a penalty. And then Rio Haryanto didn't serve a drive-through or something for speeding in the pit lane. So there was three people in the top eight starting the last lap who didn't finish there.
I didn't get it.
He was ever like 10th as he crossed the line on the last lap. Ended up Stanaway, actually. And Stanaway ended up winning the race on Sunday. It was something like that.
Maybe you're right. Yeah, I can't remember. But I think you might have been right. He definitely had a flying race in one of them where he had some super start from one of the front two rows, and he was off in the distance. I remember that. But yeah, it was a super cool car. And how would you compare that? Obviously, you did some testing around that era, GP2, then to the Formula One car, because nowadays, as we know, they've got silly downforce, silly power. Yeah. What was it like?
I think the thing with F1 testing is it's not what you'd think from the outside. And when you watch like pre-season testing and you hear all the media getting hyped up about X, Y, and Z going quick and that. And, I remember one day in the Manor, they were quite kind to me on fuel levels and tyre and right time of day. And we were like 2/10 off the Mercedes. And it's just like, but we know we're 3 seconds off the Mercedes. and then like the following day, you're then like 4 seconds off the Mercedes, but we're running 60 kilos of fuel and old tyres, whatever. So you just know that there's so much extra things going on behind the scenes, where it's not like in junior formula, everyone's pretty much running low fuel and everyone's pretty much always on the best tyres. Where in Formula One, they're just like messing out, taking different wings on, doing all this stuff. So actually your testing job isn't about kind of how fast you can go. It's about how well you can relay the information and the data. So actually, I bet if I put an a GP2 car on the track at the same time as I was testing in F1, I'd probably enjoy driving the GP2 car more because you're always on the limit. Yeah, I could probably count on one hand how many kind of full beans laps I've done in a Formula One car. And when you do them, you are like, wow, it's the first time I've ever driven a car that I've actually gone, yeah, this is quick. Other time you take it in your stride. But yeah, I remember the first time I turned the engine up to it was like the quali map. And I came out of the last corner and like put my foot down to start the lap. And I was like, holy...
But why do you think, to sort of like explain it to the casual fan who probably wouldn't know why they do that, why do they test like 60 kilos, low power, all of that, when in terms of performance the conditions are so different when it comes to it in qualifying?
I suppose in short, they only win points on a Sunday. And the race result is where they make their money. Qualifying at the front is great and it helps, so they do focus on that a little bit, but they also can't change the car overnight from a Saturday to a Sunday. So there's no point building a car that's super fast for qualifying if you then can't race it on a Sunday. So they really try and strike the balance between making sure the car's still quick for qualifying, but then also you've got the quickness and the longevity for a race.
What circuits did you actually test? I can't remember if I'm honest. What circuits did you actually test on?
I've got them up on the board there. You did
Silverstone, didn't you?
Sorry?
You did Silverstone, didn't you?
Yeah, I did Silverstone, Barcelona, Austin, Abu Dhabi, and a couple of those I did two or three times.
Oh, okay, nice. And did you do in season tests, or was it simply FP1s? Because I know you did a couple of FP1s.
I did. Austin was FP1 and Abu Dhabi was FP1. I did another Abu Dhabi post-season test, so that was like the rookie test. Barcelona was also a rookie test. And then I did another Barcelona, which was a whole day in Barcelona as well.
So that's the biggest reference.
That's always quite cool. So the end of season test has most of the real race drivers in, and so did Barcelona pre-season. And, you know, growing up playing on the PlayStation with someone like Kimmy, you know, who's been around forever. I'd just come out of the pits and he'd like come past me as I came out of the pits and then came around to start my push lap. And, you know, he was like 3 seconds in front of me or whatever. And then by the time we got to like turn 7-8 in Abu Dhabi, I'm starting to catch him up as he's on his cool down. And he's then like pulled over to one side and just like, that's quite cool. Like, it's a strange feeling. And obviously you feel like you should be there and you're capable of being there, but it's still like, this is actually quite cool. Or like the free practice in Austin, as I came out the pits, you know, a bit rabbit in the headlights sort of thing. And I've come through turn one, and Sebastian Vettel's come out of the pits behind me. And I'm like, yeah, just take it easy. Don't do anything stupid. Like, don't light the rears up. Just bah, bah, bah. And Seb's just like wheel spinning past me coming out of turn one. I'm like, it's quite cool actually, isn't it?
I had actually quite a similar one in 2016 in Barcelona going through turn three. And I was just on an outlap, like you say. And they were like, oh, Rosberg's coming by, he's 5 seconds back. And I just pulled to the inside out of turn three and I just had the biggest smile on my face. I was like, that's so cool. Just talking to myself. And then in 2019, when I did it as well, they didn't tell me on a cool down lap that I can't remember if it was Lando or it was Ricardo that were coming. Man, I blocked him. Like, I couldn't believe. I was like, I'm so sorry. So it can go one or the other way.
If it was one of the younger drivers, I'd have been like blocking them and running them out the road. But then the older ones would be like, okay.
Yeah, you've got my respect. Yeah, exactly.
I've seen some dodgy things in testing from young drivers, like putting people off in the gravel and they've blocked them and stuff like that.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
you don't want to be doing that.
On testing, if you're not a race driver, you have a green light on the back.
Yeah, so constant.
Red light, you have a constant green light. And I remember seeing that for the first time, being like, why have I got a green light? And then they explained, and I felt like such a billy.
A novice again. Like with your X plates in karting.
Yeah, exactly. It's like everyone's driving around being like, oh, that's a bandit in that car.
It's like that first day at PF all over again.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, I've been racing now for like 15 years. I can't still be that person.
That's very good.
How close did you get to getting a seat, like a race seat?
I've been asked this question so many times over the years. And
well, you can give the answer to us for the first time. The
first answer is, well, it didn't happen, so it's a fictional question. I would like to think I can look myself in the mirror and say there was a good chance if the team survived, but the team didn't, and I'm sitting here now, and I'm not making a seat in an F1 car. So,
yeah.
I can't dwell on it too much, otherwise I think I'd be clinically depressed.
Yeah. No, that's just being inside, mate. That's COVID for you. But it is super difficult to make that break unless you've got a huge amount of funding or the team that you've got has picked you up from a young age. We always talk about these driver programs, and if you're fortunate to get on a proper one, i.e. the Red Bull program, or, you know, the Ferrari guys are being treated very well currently, some people from Mercedes, then I think to break through, unless you have either huge backing financially from family or sponsors, then it's, I wouldn't say impossible, but you have to be, one in a trillion sort of thing.
But even as you alluded to on the like young driver program that some of the teams have, they're not always as good as they seem. You know, when you actually get contracts on the table from some of them, they're not always as good as they seem. And as much as they've made some drivers' careers, they've also destroyed a lot of drivers' careers. So, you know, I think the end kind of process of 20 drivers on a Formula One grid looks rosy. And this whole question of, you know, how do we get more people into the sport and everything? It's like, well, you've got to remember, for every one person that makes Formula One, there's probably another 1,000 kids that didn't make it. You know, it is still an elite sport and it is still, you know, a top end cutthroat industry.
Completely right. Completely right. And after your sort of stint in the Formula One world and whatever, you head over to stateside. So you went to go and try and do a bit of IndyCar, or you did a bit of IndyCar, a couple of Indy 500s. Having been out there only to race for the first time end of last year in Sebring, just in an IMSA race, it was the most fun I think I've had ever racing a car, to be honest with you. So how was that IndyCar experience? Firstly, we'll talk about the IndyCar, the normal road courses, the car itself. And then, yeah, talk us through the Indy 500, man, because that'd just be awesome.
Well, go back to the car. It's a really cool car. It's up there in the top couple of cars I've driven. I think the only thing that just lets it down is the weight. But they kind of have to have the weight from all the safety side of things they have for the ovals. You know, you take a hammer to the side pod of a Formula One car and it would disintegrate into 1,000 bits. You take a hammer to the side of an Indy car and the hammer breaks, you know. they're solid bits. You know, when you see them in the race, they're like bouncing into each other like touring cars, but they're single seaters. And I remember it was a driver coach of the team said to me, he said, "Oh, as long as you get them sideways enough, it'll be fine and they'll bounce off you." And that was the first race of the year in St. Pete. And I was in second in the race. Wickens was leading. And Rossi was just trying to overtake me. He went around the outside into what had been about turn four. And he was ahead. And that under braking, I just, in the back of my mind, was Lee just saying, "As long as it's pod to pod, you'll be all right." So I just came off the brake. And just,
see you, mate.
And
hazard him.
Carried on in second. But like the stewards didn't care. It was fine. Like it was racing. Where you look in F1 now, it's like as soon as they get side by side, there's penalties flying left, right, and centre. So it was a much more relaxed racing environment. Cars were good to drive. They were pretty bulletproof from that standpoint. And yeah, the racing was good. And everyone's much more friendly. Like you go to like a driver's signing interview, and it was the first weekend I'd ever been there. You know, it's like Scott Dixon came up and he's like, "All right, how's it going? You know, having a chat, our first weekend, all that." And then I sat next to Will Power and he was the same. You know, these guys have been there for years and won championships and stuff. And then, you know, then I think back to like my Formula One days. I never went to one driver's briefing in an F1 paddock where anyone who'd been there for more than like 2 years said hello to me. And it was just like, you just felt isolated and like you were kind of treading on their feet. Where you go to America, everyone's just happy and the fans are happy to see you. They're like grateful that you've even blessed them
over
your presence to be alive when you turn up at a racetrack. So it's just like a really chilled, nice environment. They don't have all of the big awnings with all the boards, and you know, they turn up with like two or three trucks, you're in a tent. Most of the tracks don't have garages. So yeah, from that side of things, it was mega. On the other side, maybe it was a bit too relaxed. We had some things go wrong with the car where you just think that really shouldn't have gone wrong with the car. If you just spent kind of 10 more minutes on the car, it wouldn't have gone wrong, sort of thing. So yeah, it's both ends of it. But actually, from experience, you know, I lived there for a year as well. It was a cool life experience. I'd like to still be racing in the championship, but.
It's difficult again to get the right sponsorship and get the right deals and whatever, because in IndyCar, from the outside anyway, you always see either you're with Penske, Ganassi,
Andretti.
Yeah, those three that probably have sponsors that come to the actual team and then they provide the driver, or all the drivers are bringing some sort of big sponsorship deal or backing from somewhere. It seems they're all brilliant drivers, don't get me wrong, and probably all getting paid, but they might be taking a cut off the sponsorship, not necessarily getting paid by.
It's no different to the way the rest of the motorsport world works, really. Even some really good drivers, when you kind of knock on the door and start asking questions and you thought one deal was maybe better than you'd expect, and actually it turns out that even that really good driver is having to find his own budget from somewhere, you know, or has helped a situation to get that money over the line and certain things like that. And it just makes it difficult. But at the end of the day, it's a sport that is expensive. Mm. It's like polo. it's expensive to go racing. And
polo expensive?
Man, you have no idea how expensive those horses are.
Oh, really? Am I really like naive here?
Well, out of touch.
Not quite in the quite the right level of British aristocracy to
like full Brummy. I'm being right now, and I
not in the market for a polo horse.
Yeah, you're not in the market for.
I thought that was a car. Never heard of the sport before.
And so, I mean, IndyCar itself, I would love to drive one. I think it's brilliant. I think the cars look mega. I was there in Indy as well, at the street circuit, when they were doing a race last year, when we were doing an endurance race, and it looks mega. We look round RLL, because obviously they run the M8 for BMW as well, so we know the guys there, and it looked super cool. But another thing I wouldn't be so keen on, I haven't ever done it, so you need to enlighten me on how wild it was super speedways, so Indy 500, obviously not just driving the car at 230-240 miles an hour average, but the experience of the whole week. What was it like?
Well, literally as you said that, and then I started thinking about it, like I did get shivers again. It's a cool experience, and it's a mental thing to do. If you just took the average Joe, put him in a car, like, it's hard enough to drive these cars anyway, but once you kind of get going, you could drive around a normal circuit and you'd get around, it might take you 10 minutes, but you could get around it. When you go on the super speedways, it's, you know, even for like myself, who's done a lot and driven for a long time in my life, it's like you're a duckling in water again. Like, you're just learning how to swim. And your perception of speed is just wrong. Whatever you've thought is quick in the past, it's just wrong. And then once you get to a point that you're now comfortable and you're doing pretty well, and you've done like your first full lap flat, and you're like, I am now the world's greatest racing driver. I've done one lap flat. And it's like, yeah, but you've got to do 200 of those in a race. So yeah, you've got yourself like a couple of days in, and the team were really good. They like coached me through it all. And I'd been there the year before with ECR. Like, so I followed them everywhere. I was in all the meetings. I watched everything, spoke to everyone about it. So I kind of knew what to expect. And then the team still coached me through it, which was RLR. Yeah. And they always isolate you on the track to start off with, and you always have a little bit more downforce on. But the first time they send you out in the pack with low downforce, you've just been thrown it into a whirlpool without a paddle, and you're just so I came out, and then the spotter is just like, hey, you can go high. So I've slotted into the train, and no joke, within a lap and a half I was at the back of the train. All 15 cars have overtaken me. Like, it was just
what's going on then?
Yeah. I was like, do you want me to come in and we'll try again? That was useful.
So how on edge are the cars? Like, because obviously when you watch them on TV, you see the small sort of steering movements that are going on, but you can't really.
The way the cars are set up now, they've changed the aero package over the years. So if I was to talk you through my qualifying lap, so this is out of traffic, and the wind changes direction, and all the corners are supposed to be the same, but they're all just slightly different. And the wind at 240 miles an hour, the wind plays even more of a difference. You both know that a headwind can change your brake zone by 10 meters.
Yeah, sure.
Well, a headwind at 240 miles an hour changes everything massively, like how much you even have to just turn into the corner. The cars are normally set up to want to go left. So if you've got a decent enough headwind, you almost don't have to turn for the corner. You just kind of half let go, just apply a little bit of weight, and it just goes through. I remember the first like five laps of a race run we did in a train, and I was knackered. Like, my neck was hanging off, like my legs, my glutes, my arms were just, everything was hurting. And I came in, I was like, just give me 5 minutes. I need to like reassess. And they were just like, just relax. And it becomes the weirdest thing ever, because obviously everything's locked in, but you just become like a blob in the car. And the only thing that you're moving is your hands and your feet. Yeah. So you do everything from your ankles, and you don't support yourself at all. So you just end up like laughing into the car. strangest thing.
Do you get like a special seat, mate?
8G. So you need a really strong seat around you, and you just let yourself. And like a seat that you can hardly move in when you're sitting in the pits. Once you're going around the corner, you can like get your hand down the side of your rib cage and the seat. Like that's how much you compress yourself into the side of the seat.
Do you get like a special seat for that race? Like maybe more on one side or not?
Some people do a little bit. The world's greatest saving grace that they have in IndyCar is a carbon like centerboard that goes in between your legs, so your legs can't move. So rather than like they do in F1, put pads and stuff, there's just your legs can't move. So yeah, okay. It actually really saves your hips. I know it sounds something stupid, but because your legs can't move, you never have to like switch your core on and your hips on to hold your legs in place. So you can literally just move your ankles and that job's good.
Yeah.
And do they keep that in for the street courses as well, or is that just for the Indy 500?
No, they do. It's so bumpy on the street courses as well. It's like
there's me thinking it was just four corners to turn left.
Yeah, well, so on my qualifying lap, turn one was pretty neutral. So let's say turn one was the 0 point. So turn one was 0 point, but turn two had a world's worst crosswind through it. So you had the most serious oversteer. Just it was every time through there. It was the corner Hinch crashed on his qualifying lap. But yeah. Every time through there, you were just like, I'm going to crash. And you'd like get through, you'd be like, whew, I made it. So anyway, you go through turn one, no changes for argument's sake. But then you'd have like preset on the dash what you wanted to do with like the weight jacker and the bars. So in the short shoot, which is no more than probably like 0.1 of a second, you're like pressing the buttons on the steering wheel to change how much weight jacker you've got to go to the left, and then going softer on the rear bar to try and settle the rear down. But then as you come out, you have to collapse the weight jacker, because if you collapse the weight jacker, the rear drops down, you're quicker down the straight. So you come out of like turn two, and basically you get to the point that you're like, I'm not going to hit the wall, and you like press the button to collapse the weight jack. And if you get it wrong, you just slide up into the wall because you just lose the downforce. So that's why you see when people just look like they stupidly just hit the wall. You're like, why do they do that? But that's because it was decided like 300 meters ago, and there's nothing you can do to like, you can't just put a bit of extra lock in and like you and I would on a normal road course. You can't just go, oh, I'll just turn a little bit more. It'll be all right. Like you just, that's your trajectory. Do you remember Alonso spanked it into the wall, but like massively, like really hard?
Yeah.
He judged it. He just got it wrong, and he thought he had more grip than he did, and he just, and there's nothing you can do.
No.
So then turn three was the highest top speed. We were about 242 miles an hour on turning into turn three. But you'd have an understeer turning, but then it would grip up because you'd pick up a bit of a front headwind through turn three. So you turn in, you'd wind the lock on, you go, oh, this is not good, but I've got to keep it pinned, And then, you've got to remember to re-engage the weight jacker when you get to the corner, otherwise that's game over as well. You go with this understeer and then suddenly it grips, you have to like wind the lock off. But then into the next one, you've got a massive front end on the way in, but then understeer, but it was 2 points on the way in. So you then have to go back softer again on the rear on the way into the corner, but then collapse the weight jacker even earlier mid-corner. So you then lose the rear grip before it understeers up high. And then you just do that four times. It's like so much going on.
What the hell?
And then like one lap round, like, oh, I had a little bit too much understeer here. And like watching the speed traces, is pretty much just a flat line with like a couple of dips. And you're looking at like 0.1 of a mile an hour as a difference of speed between like myself and Takuma Sato. And you're like, where's the time? And you just can't see it.
No, it's all that little tiny little feeling kind of thing, isn't it? It's a completely mad feeling. And we could talk about, I'm sure, for hours, particularly between us three, because obviously myself and Jake have never done it before. So it's something that
I'll try and pick your brain.
Experience that. we're going to have a few bike rides and coffees and then maybe come back on here.
Not with him, he's an Ironman.
He's an Ironman. Ah, well, that's all right. Well, he can go on a mountain bike then.
Have you seen his bike?
Nah. Well, he's ride
still got that Trinity, Boardman. Giant Trinity.
Yeah, well, I've not used it to be in the winter, but yeah, I got myself a nice TT bike. Well, I had this great idea last year that I'd do an Ironman, and then COVID came around, but I was getting myself ready.
Yeah, get yourself ready fully. So now you're going to be ready for what this year? I mean, what's racing looking like? Obviously, it's been difficult since coming out single seaters. It always is for everyone, unless you get in that lucky spot where you can jump into a GT car and prove yourself. Because it seems like, although you have this huge pedigree and great results within, you know, the single seater fold, then going to the GT cars, you have to prove yourself again. Then you'll get picked up and it sort of flies forward through there. So what can you tell us about what you're working on or what you want to be doing, just so the fans know?
Working on everything. Trying to get in a race car somewhere. Obviously, I've made the transition over to the World Endurance, you know, the endurance side and the GT side, but more prototypes rather than outright GTs. Tested a little bit in some GTs. But again, it still proves pretty difficult, as you guys know. A lot of it does come down to funding still, again. Last year I had a few things sorted out. I was supposed to be doing Ginetta with LMP1, which was really cool, really nice car to drive, actually. A little bit of F2 stuff with High Tech, but that fell over in the end. Coming into this year, there's not a lot real driving happening at the moment. Still working on it, trying to find everything can. There's lots of openings, but nothing that I can go into and still pay my mortgage, if we put it that way. At the moment, I'm doing a similar role to you, Nick, and Brian, Jake, for Aston and Merck, respectively. But I'm at Alpine, which was Renault last year. So that's on the sim, doing all their development side of things for them. And then a similar role with a bit like Jake at Venturi, actually, with Mahindra in Formula E, their kind of development reserve driver there. So at the weekend, I didn't go to the races, but we were on the sim doing all their stuff, getting them ready for the race weekend. So that's the majority of my time at the moment between those two. Real driving, working on it. Anyone watching this that wants to give me a drive, then
exactly, that's why I mentioned it, mate. You can plug yourself as much as you want, and then you never know, someone may get COVID and you're free. Well, and jump in.
That's the thing, isn't it? It's the year to be a reserve driver. Well, it was last year also, when you look at Nico and Hulkenberg and people like that. But I think the world is still settling down, isn't it? Well, not even in the point of settling down, it's like still in it, but hopefully we think the next few months it will start to, and I think the teams will start to sort of see what, you know, budgets they have, how many cars they plan to run, how many people are bringing money to those cars, and sort of be able to forecast it a bit better, I guess. And I think right now there's a lot of teams that are going in the worst case, you know, scenario and asking for money a lot of the time.
Yeah. But as you say, there's always a chicken and the egg, isn't it? Which one goes first? There's plenty of drivers that will just sign early because they can. And then there's others that will sign late because they think that's the best way to get a deal. And then there's kind of everyone else in between. And then there's people that just sign late because they couldn't get in anywhere else.
Yeah.
It'll wait and see, really, see what unfolds as kind of, as you say, the world pans itself out.
Yeah, no, I'm sure it'll work out, mate. No, like I said, there'll be plenty of opportunities. And when these big manufacturers then have more confidence in what's going to go on, unfortunately, after COVID, there's a bit of shaky legs, I'm sure, in the high end of each company.
Once you've seen this podcast as well, though.
Yeah, and the podcast with 10 million views, then we'll be all good to go.
Well, what's the title going to be? You need to, you know, have a catchy title to get those 10 million views.
Indy 500/F1 superstar Jordan King comes on
slash to speak to
talk a load of rubbish for an hour.
Yeah. Weight jackers.
Weight jackers and stuff that we don't know about Indy 500. So it'll be something like that.
I'm giving away all the trade secrets now. What if not all the teams have that? And now I've just I've just explained how...
Could be an opening, because now you've got to go and drive it and test it, you know, prove it out, because you know how the system works.
I know it works, and
exactly.
I could be, or I could even be just employed as an engineer of just fountain of knowledge.
You could run Mr. Karting.
Yeah.
There you are, new business.
I might actually might go back to karting, just start winning like world championships in karting again.
And then just fast track it after. I've done a bit of that.
I've won, and then just rock up in F1 and go, well, but Dave did it last time, so he won a world championship. Why can't I do it?
Alan and Mr. Karting said I was good enough.
It's this one time.
Like, look, here's my CV. Al, Mr. Karting, instead. So where do I sign?
Brilliant. Okay then, mate. Well, yeah, really appreciate you coming on. I know you've got to shoot off. So, again, thanks for coming on. Also, thanks to the guests and listeners from the HYM podcast. Make sure you follow Jordan on social media and come back here next week for a brand new episode of the podcast. His title and everything will be below at 42 Jordan King, as well as at HYM podcast. Make sure you like and subscribe. And of course, get in the comments any other questions or guests you want on. Keep hassling us and we'll get them on. So, to everyone, thanks again for listening, and catch up soon. Cheers.
Cheers, guys.
Cheers, guys.